For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
I want to talk today about two Zen stories. One is Buddhist and one is not. And I imagine a number of you have heard both of these stories, and probably most of you have heard at least one. The first one I want to talk about, so far as I know, it's an American Indian story. I don't know if that's true, but that's the way I've always heard it. But it could probably be from any number of cultures. And it has to do with a situation where, you know, one guy approaches an older, perhaps wiser person and asks, you know, what is the foundation of the world? What does the world rest on? What supports it? And the answer was, well, it rests on the back of a giant turtle. The guy took that in for a moment and he said, well, what's the turtle standing on? And the guy said, well, that turtle stands on the back of an even bigger turtle. The guy sort of took that in for a moment. I said, well, what about that turtle? And he says, well, it's an even bigger turtle that one stands on. And the guy says, well, what about that turtle? And the guy says, it's turtles all the way down. And I remember the first time I heard this story, my response was exactly what a lot of you had. It was kind of a chuckle and, you know, how interesting, you know, kind of funny, kind of amusing. But as I've thought about this story over the years, I think that it has many of the features of the kind of stories about the world that we tell ourselves. And there's a certain you know, elegance and beauty to it. It has the same logical structure of the kinds of stories we still tell ourselves. So probably those of you who have been following the news know that the Higgs boson particle was a so-called God particle, seems to have been identified, you know, and this is, they call it the God particle because of its supposed explanatory power of tying together the so-called standard model of physics that has to do, it makes coherent, makes the story of how all the forces that have, physical forces have been identified other than gravity, sort of cohere and make sense. However, there's still the problem of trying to figure out how our now more coherent story of the standard model ties together with gravitation, the problem of a unified theory, the problem of how to meld these two very powerful stories we have of general relativity on one side and quantum physics on the other side. And, you know, I don't know. I'm not in a position to know. I'm not a scientist. But I'm guessing that when those two things are put together, there will still need to be a story about what that rests on. And I imagine, because that's the case, that at some point, it will always be turtles all the way down. There's a limit to what we can know. And this will always be the world in which we live, ultimately. So the second story comes from one of the early Buddhist discourses, some of the, you know, earliest recorded discourses of Buddha, and this is about a guy, a disciple of his named Malankyaputta. This guy apparently also was greatly concerned about, you know, what is it that supports the world? What does the world rest on? And seemed to get a little annoyed with Shakyamuni, his teacher, because the Buddha didn't seem to talk about this very much. Didn't seem to talk about it at all. So Malankalputta came to the Buddha one morning and said, you know, look, Buddha, you have left many things undeclared. It's the term they use here, unanswered. You haven't addressed what certain things that Malankalputta sees as these very important questions. And he spells them out, you know, the concerns of his day. You haven't said whether the universe is infinite, or the world. He uses the term world, but he means everything. Whether the world is infinite or is not infinite, whether the world is eternal or not eternal. You haven't said anything about whether, how does he put it, whether the soul or the self is the same as the body, or the soul is one thing and the body another, or after death, a Tathagata, a Buddha, exists or does not exist, or both exists and does not exist, or neither exists nor not exists. Pretty inclusive range there. And that last question, actually later in the history of Buddhist philosophy, you know, it's the so-called tetralemma that gets developed in Madhyamaka philosophy to the conclusion that, you know, we cannot, in fact, make assertions. That's besides the point here. You know, but the obviously, you know, this question about the soul and the body has to do, seems to be presupposed on a doesn't even necessarily make a lot of sense in the Buddhist context, because it seems to presuppose a notion of a kind of self that in the Buddha's words we can't apprehend. And then this other thing, you know, the thing about the Tathagata and its continued existence after death, etc., etc., you know, raises all these questions about, you know, any kind of continuity, personal continuity, rebirth, all those things. So obviously Malankalputta is struggling to create for himself some kind of a story upon which he thinks he will be able to establish his practice. And stories are a lot, you know, Tsagen sometimes talks about opposable thumbs, and, you know, you think about it, and everything that we have here, you know, my robes, this little machine, you know, the transmission of the sutra in this written form, my watch, you know, all depend on this miracle of our opposable thumbs. In the same way, you know, we have this miraculous, impressive story-making capacity. We tell ourselves stories about turtles. We, you know, tell ourselves stories about what we can really base our lives on, what we can really base our practice on. But just as the thumb, you know, has this wonderful creative power, it's also responsible for a range of all sorts of destructive things that we've unleashed in the world that we're responsible for in a way that, for example, dolphins will not be called to account for. Likewise, we do the same. Our stories can get us into trouble, and they can particularly get us into trouble with regard to practice. So this guy, you know, Malankalputta, presents this to the Buddha, and he says, well, you know, you have to declare yourself on these things, or, you know, I'm gone, I'm no longer your disciple, I'm go elsewhere. And the Buddha responds basically to the effect that he uses the metaphor of someone who has been shot with an arrow and is bleeding on the field. And he says to Malankalputta, he says, look, you know, this, your situation is like somebody who's been wounded on the battlefield, and you know, you're bleeding to death. You've got to take the arrow out and do something. And you're like a guy who, in that situation, rather than pulling the arrow out, just directly pulling the arrow out, starts asking a series of questions. And he goes on at length here. You know, I'll just read a little section of it. You know, it starts with sort of the bigger questions and just proliferates into a whole range of things. Suppose, Malankalputta, a man were wounded by an arrow thickly smeared with poison, and his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives, brought a surgeon to treat him. The man would say, I will not let the surgeon pull out this arrow until I know whether the man who wounded me was a noble or a Brahmin or a merchant or a worker. And he would say, I will not let the surgeon pull this arrow out until I know his name and the clan, until I know whether the man who wounded me was tall or short. And it just goes on and on, you know, to what kind of feathers were used on the arrow and da-da-da-da. And he concludes, Buddha concludes by saying, all this would still not be known to that man, and meanwhile, he would die. So too, Malankalputta, if anyone would say thus, I will not lead the holy life under the Blessed One until the Blessed One declares to me the world is eternal, etc., 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 that person will die before he's got answers. That's interesting, you know, so, and that's a part of the story I've always sort of responded to, and, you know, in the next couple of pages, you know, Buddha goes on to say, well, I'll tell you what I am willing to declare. So he says, all those questions, he uses the term, they're not beneficial. They don't help you in the situation you're in, because in the Saha world we're in, we have suffering, dukkha, lamentation, grief, sorrow, all these sort of existential sort of issues that we have to contend with. And in many ways, they're, I mean, in any kind of real way, they're much more pressing than these sort of more metaphysical, bigger questions that we can get so wrapped up in. And then the Buddha says, so, you know, I will not declare these things because it's, he doesn't say he can't do it, it's an open question to me, but he says it's not beneficial to do so. It's not beneficial to you to do so. So I tell you what I do declare. I declare the truth of suffering. I declare the truth that suffering has a cause. I declare the truth that there's a way to address our suffering. And I declare the truth that the way to do that is the Noble Eightfold Path. So it's the Four Noble Truths. This is what the Buddha says. You know, this is how we are going to pull out this arrow that you're suffering with. And I don't know how familiar you all are, but you know, just to sort of quickly read them through, so I make sure not to leave any out, the Eightfold Path that the Buddha proposes has to do with right or noble or effective view, intention, speech, action, livelihood, effort, energy, mindfulness, and meditation. And the Buddha says that, you know, these are how we pull the arrow out. But the part of the story that I never noticed before until I was reading it the other day is just—it's just said in passing. I find it really interesting. He says, "Malankalputta, if there is the view that the world is eternal, the holy life, i.e., the life of practice, cannot be lived." And it's not just because that's like an incorrect view, because he says, and if there is a view that the world is not eternal, the holy life cannot be lived. Whether there is a view the world is eternal, or the view the world is not eternal, there is birth, there is aging, there is death. So, all these things. And I find this so interesting because it's not a matter of, you know, when we make those assertions, getting them right. But it seems to me that the Buddha is claiming here that even regardless of the ultimate correctness or adequacy or accuracy of the view, there's a problem in holding a view with regard to our practice that makes the execution, carrying out of our practice, problematic. It seems to say it has a way of subverting it before we ever start. And I'm thinking, well, what an interesting thing to say, you know, and what a terrible predicament it puts us all in. So where does this connect to? And it seems to connect with the first part of this path, you know, something about view and something about why would having a view of any kind about ultimate things, to put it in Dogen's term, Dogen's the founder of our particular line of Buddhism, is a 13th century Japanese monk. Why would holding any view be problematic? And I think it connects to the second part of these Four Noble Truths, the truth that suffering has a cause, which Buddha elsewhere identifies as a kind of clinging and a kind of grasping that's sort of the mutated or corrupted or interfered with manifestation of our desire. And you know, so I think it has to do with when, you know, like what Malankhya Putta is doing. He's trying to like really nail down what the biggest turtle is, because if he can nail down what his big turtles are, you know, then he feels like he can carry out, as it's put here, live out the holy life, because he'll know what to do. He'll have that foundation, he'll have that security. And I think the implication here is that, you know, with the establishment of any view of this sort, that there gets to be a circular pattern going. We, you know, think we can make some indubitable statement, assertion about the universe, and therefore trace out the our place in it. And likewise, if we can, you know, start from ourselves, you know, then we can get to some sort of overarching understanding of the way things are, you know. And the problem is that because of how we're constituted, all of those views, they're reflective of our desire, of our grasping, and you know, like what, and it gets to be the circular thing, you know, ultimately. Having these views sort of supports a certain notion of self. Then we have a certain notion of self that we think we can support a view of the universe, turtles all the way down, you know, whatever it may be. And that's samsaric. That's the process that keeps the arrow firmly embedded in us. It's important, you know, this grasping, you know, when we tend to think of it, when we think of it, we tend to think it's our attachment to whatever it might be, you know, a particular kind of food, a particular kind of... We think of it in these sort of crudely materialist terms, you know, having this, having the nice car, having the beautiful wife, you know, whatever it might be. And those are all part of it. But fundamentally, I think in the Buddhist understanding, that those are secondary manifestations, because all of those things are supports ultimately for supporting a notion that we are in fact a kind of unified, coherent, substantive self that we use to as the turtle upon which to rests the mystery of our presence here and now. And Buddha says that's not helpful. So the problem is, Buddha says, well, okay, you have any of these views, whatever they are, it will become impossible to live the holy life, the life of practice, the life that will... You'll be missing the thumbs. It'll help you pull out that arrow. And the problem is, of course, we all have all kinds of views. You know, we are thoroughly enmeshed in our not only the constructive capacity of, you know, building the physical world, but our constructive capacity to build all kinds of worlds through thought and language and storytelling. You know, so that seems to put us in a difficult spot. And you know, I don't really know how to resolve that other than to say, at least from the Zen perspective, you know, what do you do, you know, when you're at the top of a 100-foot pole? You know, you keep climbing. Likewise, when you're, you know, in a situation where you have views such that it makes it impossible to live a life of practice, what do you do? Well, the way to address that is to live a life of practice. And you may find that the hold of your views loosens over time. A lot of this has to do with, you know, that loosening has to do with patience. It has to do with tolerance. It's one of the paramitas, one of the six sort of qualities of a bodhisattvic life that some of us have been discussing lately, recently here. And it's tolerance with not knowing. It's tolerance with not trying to see beyond where your eye of practice takes you, as Dogen would say. Sometimes it's called, you know, Zen mind. It's beginner's mind, the quality of continuing to live out the Eightfold Path, continuing to live as a bodhisattva in the world without support, without grounding, without any turtles, without the Higgs boson, whatever it may be that you're looking for. So I'll just finish with this idea. I mean, I love this term. It's come up. I remember the first time I heard it, I just go, yeah, that's so good. And Taigen brings it up in his discussion of the paramitas in Faces of Compassion, and it's this term anupadika dharmika shanti, tolerance for the ungraspability of phenomena. Ultimately, we can't get a hold of it either. Can't apprehend either with the hand or with the mind. Nonetheless, we do our best to live out this this life of practice once we've had a taste for it. And this word tolerance, I'll just close with this thought. It's kind of a slightly negative tinge to it to me, because the first image I have is just like, you know, okay, you know, think of an example. You're doing zazen and you don't want to move, and a mosquito lands on your forehead, and so you just say, okay, hope it goes away soon, you know, that kind of tolerance. But I think the kind of tolerance that's being spoken of here is really the more the kind of tolerance or patience that a mother might have for her baby, you know, her child, maybe a toddler is a better example. Somebody can, you know, get into a little trouble and make mistakes and cause some havoc and so on. And so, you know, the mother does it, you know, her best to sort of guide and direct and educate within her, you know, the limited range of her power to do so, given circumstances, the personality and character of her child, which is separate from her and all those things. But there's always this, it's not just like putting up with it. There's, I mean, almost always this very deep, profound appreciation and love that goes into that situation of patience. And I think that ultimately has to be, you know, that's what we can let unfold for ourselves as we also do our best to sort of guide the unruliness and ungraspability of our own lives and the problematic situations of the world. We do our best to have a positive influence and so on. But, you know, hopefully with practice, it becomes not just sort of putting up with it, but something that we can do with appreciation and affection and love and real concern. And that's the Bodhisattva way of life. And I guess I'll just let it go there, except to note that it will be more difficult to do so if we become too wedded to our own stories of how we think things ultimately are. So encourage you just to continue to enjoy your zazen and continue to enjoy practicing the precepts. And maybe I'll stop there. Do you have something to say? Okay.
Great talk.
Thank you.
And I'm giving the talk tomorrow, and I just want to say how on the same wavelength I feel like we are.
We've done this before, or is your talk going to be like a...
It's like the... I'm going to be giving the same talk tomorrow. But I'll plug my talk, I guess, now. I just wanted to show you, I was going to call it, I was sort of thinking about this, the God particle versus the Goddess wavelength. Zazen as devotion to Prajnaparamita, mother of the Buddhas.
Oh.
This is something I'm very engaged with right now, shifting, sort of shifting emphasis from this masculine flavor of looking at things or our practice to a feminine. More feminine awareness that's embedded in our practice and all those things you were just talking about, and how we can really approach our practice instead of as an acquisition tool. But really, I often think of Keats's phrase, negative capability. It's another way to think of this tolerance for not knowing. It's actually a capability for not knowing. It's actually going to be that thumb, you know, so that we can actually move from that capability. Thank you so much for the great talk.
And, you know, I'm happy to answer, like, any questions about anything that were unclear, but I'm sort of hoping that if anybody else has any sort of questions, that somebody else in the room would make a stab at answering it. And that certainly includes everybody who's here for the first time, because the whole, basis of this thing I'm saying about, you know, none of us know all that much, so we're all kind of on unequal footing. So I invite new folks to join in if there's a...
I have a non-question. I like the story of the turtles all the way down. I once saw a comic strip by the artist Paul Pope on this story, and the last panel of the comic strip instead of saying his turtle's all the way down, the wise elder said, "Kid, you ask too many questions." I think it's very relevant to the arrow image too. It's like, stop asking questions at that moment.
Well, you know, and it's funny because it's not, I don't think it's like bad to ask questions. And, you know, just like, you know, with our opposable thumbs, we can use it correctly and incorrectly. There's this, it can be very useful to ask questions. We can learn a lot as long as we are humble about the nature of our questions and don't ask the, you know, either to ask the answers we produce to carry more than they can really carry, and also recognize that, you know, we have this uncanny, I think Buddha thinks, I think Immanuel Kant thought, that we have this capacity to generate questions that are either beyond our capacity to answer unanswerable because they somehow, in their expression, become incoherent. Anyway, yeah, it's good. Hello.
Good morning. it's interesting because I had an interesting discussion last night with some friends, and we were talking about the fact that, you know, and so one of the things I think is that there might, I think there probably are some other realities that we're oblivious to that are going on right now, and that when we ask our questions, we're going toward our way of understanding things, and that there's an importance in trying to stop the linear questions, or at least not get so obsessed with them. And when we're sitting or when we're doing other things, it's like there's an awareness of other things that becomes more present. I don't know whether that's the feminine or whether that's the intuitive mind or whether that's, I don't know what it is, but I think, you know, I wonder if there are other things to be known, but that the way we go about them takes us off in the direction we think it should go and makes us less available to tune into what is reality.
Yeah, I mean, there's that part in Dogen where he talks about letting the 10,000 things express themselves as enlightenment, as opposed to sort of carrying yourself forward. And, you know, some of these things of like generating questions and then coming to an answer, because they're connected to our sense of trying to establish this unreal sense of self, they amount to being a kind of, maybe this is too strong, but a kind of, you know, violent imposition on the world. So, and I think this is part of how sitting practice works, where we just sit and, you know, let things rise and fall of their own accord, and that kind of grasping, kind of aggressive, trying to make the world a certain way in order that it will confirm us, just kind of gets taken out of gear. Mm-hmm. And everything appears, interestingly enough, a little fresher, you know? I mean, a little, mm-hmm. It's because we're no longer just breathing our own stale air, you know?
Noticing new things or different things or in a different way.
What do you know about the phrase Tathagata Gargala, which is translated as
mm-hmm.
Where is that Buddha moment? Where is it? It's sort of like a sense of being in the pocket, the present. So you're not stretching out sort of aggressively beyond what your Buddha eye can see, what your Buddha body can feel, which is always bringing us back. Mind in its own way, stretch too far, I have to see physically.
All right.
You're making a wonderful talk.
Thank you.
So when the Higgs boson was discovered, I was kind of excited that day. Not that I'm a physicist, but I'm sort of a, you know, take interest in that stuff.
Sure.
In a little geeky, ignorant kind of way. And so, and then the next day, as I started reading more about what the implications were, I realized that because they found it at the interviews they did, it's going to be incredibly difficult to prove supersymmetry one way or another, which is going to make it hard to prove string theory. And really, there's now a fear that the large, you know, collider that they built to find this, that basically it's done all it can.
Huh.
And so there's a real possibility that they might as well mothball it. There's going to be nothing, you know, no major discoveries beyond this we've done until they can build a collider literally the size of the Milky Way. And so I got really kind of depressed the next day. Because I realized in my lifetime, I'm not going to have these answers. And you're sort of bringing it clear to me just how, you know, silly that is. I think, you know, all of science, not all of it, but a large part of science in the 20th century, in this century, keeps coming back to the fact that certain things are unknowable. Not only that we can't know them, but the structure of the universe is such that you cannot know both things at the same time.
Yeah.
Where something is and how fast it's moving. You can know one, you can know the other, you can sort of know both, but you can't really know both. And it sort of, so that drive that we have, that belief that we're going to be able to know everything, it's the same as the Garden of Eden.
Yeah.
The knowledge of good
people.
We think we're going to know it, we're going to have the right answers, and we can tell everybody else who's right and who's wrong. And that sort of grasping the ego and all of that that comes with the concept of I'm going to know the truth. I'm going to nail down that last hurdle. Just wonderfully, it brought home so much to me. Thank you.
But you're welcome.
It's amazing how a team it all ties together.
You know, and I don't think I need to do this little proviso, but please understand that I'm not making a statement against science. If they can build a, you know, in a non-damaging way, a collider as big as the Milky Way, you know, I'm not opposed. But you know, the important point is, you know, in this sutra, you know, is that whatever sort of larger story we can tell, and we will probably always be engaged in telling larger and larger stories, you know, the reality of our lives. And you can check it out for yourself. It could be an empirical question. Is we have the situation of dukkha and having to respond to that personally, existentially, practically, in our bodies, in our limited minds, and that's important. I don't mean to be like dissing science. I like it, although I don't understand.
That's a question. Make a comment to this. I think. I know no one in here is saying this, but I think it's worth saying that questioning is great. I think it's a really great activity, but I think the important thing is whether we're questioning to validate self or questioning to or orientate ourselves toward liberation.
Yeah.
I think there's a very good distinction between the two. I feel like there is an answer that the Buddha could give, but the answer is not understandable by what's the being that's asking it at that current state.
Yeah, and it's not going to be something that you can say. It's going to be something that you have to live out.